Kia ora, and welcome back to We Do B2B, the podcast by Blue Ocean, where we unpick the ins, outs, ups and downs of B2B marketing here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I'm your host, Dale Kerner, and I'm a B2B marketer like you. From emerging trends in thinking to inspiring real-world stories from smart, good people here in New Zealand, we are here to help the New Zealand B2B marketing community to become one of the best and brightest anywhere in the world. If, like me, you're a B2B marketer looking for a place to connect, learn, and be inspired, you have come to the right place. We are back here in the boardroom at the Cordis for the Southern SaaS sessions of We Do B2B. So we're here at Southern SaaS 2024, and I'm joined by Michael Philpott, who's fresh off stage talking about the role of story. Welcome.
Thanks. Fresh, sweating off stage.
Yeah, how was that? How were the lights?
Oh, the lights are great. I like the lights. The heat was good though. Really got the temperature going.
Really kind of got you invigorated and feeling alive.
Well, I am pretty active on stage compared with most speakers. So
okay.
It comes with the territory.
Now, sadly, we were in here talking to other people, so I didn't get to see the acrobatics that went on stage.
You missed a good one. Catch the next one.
I'll look forward to it. So take us through, who's Michael Philpott for the viewers at home?
Executive speaker coach for national and international conference, investment pitch coach. So I help people to design, develop, and deliver content that's focused on building liking, trust, and respect so they can win the hearts, the minds, the wallets of any audience on any stage.
Done well. Look at that. That's a pitch, and I'm guessing that's not the first time you've done that. Yeah.
Well, you know, if you teach it, you kind of need to be able to do it. That's the tricky part of my job.
That's a really interesting area because, you know, the number of times we've spoken to people, particularly in the tech space, but I think it extends to the broader community in New Zealand as well, that we're not very good at backing ourselves overseas. We're not good at selling the dream. And that seems like a space that you help people solve. Would that be fair to say?
Definitely fair to say.
Okay.
Yeah. Like the riff I just gave you then, right? That might be the hardest thing for people to do is how do they find the essence of what they do and then promote it and just say it in a way with confidence and a comfortability that's undeniable. I see people struggle with that. And then, of course, that just filters across everything else. Whatever, if there's a weak story, if there's a weak link area, then you'll see them crumble more over time as they get asked more questions about why are you the best at what you do? Why should we pay for you to do this?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, the answer is because we're the best at it, of course. And, you know, in the US, if you don't respond with because we're the best at it,
yep,
and you give some hint of self-doubt or, you know, try to be humble, well, you know, we're humble, we're all right at it.
We're like, pretty good.
But have you heard of the All Blacks? If you're not coming to the table with because we are the best at this in the world, we are the best at what we do, they will see it as a lack of not just self-doubt, but they'll see it as a lack of capability and all of that type of stuff. They do not see the Kiwi humbleness as endearing. They see it as a lack somewhere within something. Like if you're not willing to back it yourself, why should we? If you don't believe it yourself, why should we? And I know Kiwis believe in what they're doing. That's a given. They pour their heart and soul into what they do. They just haven't figured out how to just give that next step of this is why we're the best.
And sing it from the rooftops.
And sing it from the rooftops.
So how do we overcome the tall poppy piece? Because like, let's face it, I think that's part of the New Zealand psyche as well, is to chop the legs off of people who stand up and above.
Yeah.
But what we're hearing from you there is that's the very thing that some of our core markets are looking for.
Yeah. So first and foremost, I mean, the whole tall poppy syndrome subject has been, it's been an elusive one for a long time. On stage, I just basically addressed that subject of we don't have a tall poppy problem.
Okay.
We don't have a fear of speaking problem. Mm-hmm. We have a lack of skills problem. Most people weren't taught how to speak, present, or pitch at school, at college, at university, and I know that they don't even do it on a $50,000 MBA. So how is it that you all of a sudden have these necessary skills to be able to structure your content in a way that captures the hearts and minds of the people, but also present it and deliver it in a way that is powerful and convincing and charismatic? if you've never been taught. I mean, a lot of the C-suite that I work with, they've never been taught, but it's just an expected thing that, well, the higher up the chain you go, the more that you will speak. And they get up there and they just do what they've seen being done. And if we were to look at the bar in New Zealand, well, that's what we look at, right? It's like, I just watched the CEO of whatever big New Zealand company do a presentation, and let's be honest, it was average, but that is the bar. So if I'm anywhere below that and I'm rising towards it, well, I must still be doing okay.
I'm on the right track.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if we go off, we go to the US and watch someone do a presentation, here's our bar, here's theirs.
Yeah.
And it's like, we need to close that gap between. And the thing with the US is, you know, it's often referred to as being, you know, overly bravo and, you know, self-serving and all that type of stuff. But in the US, it's just, it's part and parcel. If you don't get up there and literally like, what's up, Detroit? You know, they're like, who are you?
Where's the energy?
Yeah, where's the energy? They really, really pull into the energy and the emotion and the rawness of presenting and pitching and speaking.
I hear two different threads here. One is the story aspect, and I'm interested to dig into that in terms of what makes a good story and how do you arrive at one, without giving too much away, because I think, you know, that's probably some of your training and secret sauce, so we can put a sales plug at the end, sure. But then the other piece is then presenting with power, should we say. Let's start with that one, because you are fresh off stage. What should we be doing?
To present with power.
If that's the right choice of phrase.
No, it's a really good phrase, because, I mean, it's powerful, right? Like, how do you do powerful? And there are parts of that, so we'll pull it apart. One is, it's not a presentation, it's a performance.
Okay.
Got to get your head around that straight away.
Yeah.
Like, this is not me at home. When I'm on stage, I don't, you know, Estella doesn't roll on the door, and I'm like, welcome, Estella, it is so great to see you.
Yeah.
Not all the time anyway, because that'd be a bit weird, right? I have to go, this is a performance.
Yeah.
And a performance is different to who I am, and it's bigger and bolder and louder.
Yeah.
I'm super introverted, right? Like, I'll go home and hibernate for a couple of days. But people just have this kind of thing, like, that they don't understand the difference between presentations and performances. We perform. So that brings us our power, but backing up from there, the only way you can perform without having to look at your notes, without having to refer back to something, so you can be 100% present, because presence gives you power.
Yeah.
If you're going, what am I supposed to be saying? Well, you're internalizing in your own head, which means that you're in here and you're not out there, so you failed.
Right? Yeah.
And this comes back to preparation. So the gold nugget for people is, for every minute of content that you have to deliver, it's going to require 1 hour of preparation, just in the design and development, the script writing and the development of your slides. It's going to require another 45 minutes for every minute of content for your presentation practice. So when I say the sun was coming up over the, then how's my hand going to move with it? How's my body going to really bring power to that? How does my body create visual images for my audience to see what I'm speaking about?
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, I was thinking this, but on the other hand, I was thinking this. And if I could only bring those two thoughts closer together, maybe I could.
Yeah.
Who teaches you that for a start? But, you know, you have to have a written script to be able to then pull that apart and go, how do my body movements go with what I've written? And people underestimate the amount of time necessary to do that. So a 10-minute talk will need a minimum of 17 and a half hours preparation. I just delivered a 30-minute talk. Do the math.
Yeah.
And that's dedication, determination, and discipline. That's what's required to be powerful. Power also comes from just letting go, right? Like, there's a lot of insecurity that comes with this. And within script writing and development, we find who we really are as a person, right? You jump in front of a camera and you find out who you are real quick. You know, the fake you is kind of like, hi, everyone. It's like, I don't know how to be me. And it's like, yeah, just keep going and you'll find you. But when we get on stage, we're trying to find that you, and then just make it bigger. Mm. Like, make you bigger. Don't try and be someone else. Be you, but just bigger and more powerful.
Confidently, unrestrictedly you.
Yeah. Yeah. And that takes courage, man. It takes so much courage. Like, I look at my inspiration for power and presentation would be Jim Carrey.
Okay.
Like, Jim Carrey, just like everything is so over the top, right? And it's like, when I practice Jim Carrey level.
Yeah.
So that when I get on a stage, I know that I'm going to have a shrink. There's going to be a shrink. It's like, there are all these people looking at me, right? So if I practice to here, when I shrink, I'm going to be here, right?
Yeah.
But if I practice to Kiwi,
yeah,
when I shrink,
you're going to be boring as batshit.
It's going to be scary.
Yeah.
It's going to be boring for them, but it's going to be really like nasty for me, because in that moment I'm going to discover that I didn't prepare enough.
Mm.
And there is nothing worse than that feeling of like, yeah, I should have prepared more.
What else then does it take to take your performance from something that's terrifying to something that's enjoyable? Because you've got an energy coming off of you right now that says you love what you've just gone and done out there. Even though you said you're going to go and hibernate for 3 days afterwards.
So what does it take to get from like terrified or whatever it is to enjoying it? I mean, I do this for a job, right? This is my job. I have the luxury of having that thing other people don't, right? This is my niche. This is my field. This is the area where I have to shine. I love the mindset of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like, I think best kind of spoken about is you're a conduit. That's all you are. There's powerful information that you hold, and then there's a group of people that desperately need to hear that and experience that and feel it, and you are the conduit between them. And if you have self-consciousness, self-doubt, if you have anything, it's going to just close the gap on that conduit for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can think more about your audience's needs than your own, you can step out there and be super powerful. And you get to enjoy it.
And that's a challenge for marketers. I mean, I don't know how much you interact with marketers in the world that you're in, but I mean, we are a discipline that is plagued by imposter syndrome.
Yep.
Because let's face it, it's nearly always the sales guys that get the bonus and the lobster dinner.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to marketers who are in that journey and looking to refine their performance when it comes to disseminating information, being a conduit, like you said?
Charisma.
Okay.
Right, so you've got, what's the difference between marketing and sales? So marketing know what's going on. Sales know some of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So who, at the end of it, who is riding on charisma,
mm-hmm.
and who is falling back on their knowledge?
Mm.
Right, so those in marketing know content, context, they know that stuff. Those in sales know people.
Mm.
Yeah, and it would be no different from me working with a professor or a PhD. They have a vast amount of knowledge, but they have mistakes they make that make the audience see them as a potential threat. And what happens is when we see someone as a potential threat, we will close off to them,
mm-hmm.
right? As in, it's unconscious. It's just, for example, I'm an academic, I jump on stage and I think that it's fitting that I speak for the first 15 minutes about why I have the authority to be in the room talking to you today. And of course, my facial expressions are downward, I'm quite stern, and the audience is just like, yeah, you're a potential enemy.
Mm.
And then you get someone in sales who kind of like love boat theme cued, slides on stage and goes, the love boat. And they're like, hey, hi, everyone.
Yeah.
Do you know what you need to change your life and why you should change your life? Straight to the point. No authority needed because I've got swagger and charisma.
And you're on stage.
And you're on stage, right? Yeah. And
you've earned your place there already.
Yeah. And the thing there is that the salesperson doesn't necessarily have the knowledge. They have the charisma.
Mm.
And you know, if I'm working with you know, PhD or marketers or whatever, it's like you have the wealth of knowledge.
Yeah.
Now you just need to just bring the skill of the charisma, right? And that's the cool thing. So my whole talk is charisma is a learnable skill. It's not a gift or a God-given talent that you either have or you don't. It's a learnable skill.
Sorry, I'm watching your body motions there as you're doing that, and I can see that you've prepped. I can see the hour and 45 minutes that went into that 10 seconds of delivery.
Exactly, right? And it's like, if I can do that, if I can do just these movements, and if I can make my face, like my eyes, light up on command, and then have this smile and do these things, you're like, I trust you and I like you. And you can actually teach me something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like all of that. And I like the fact that you talk about it being learnable. It makes it very, very approachable from the marketer's camp. I want to talk about story because there is an enormous amount of impact that the right one can have. Words, narrative, all of that thing, hugely close to my heart. Love that stuff. What makes a good story?
Any story that takes us on that journey, right? Like, there are stories, different stories for different purpose, different fit. So, you know, analogies and stories, they're different places. So I just told a story about, you know, the two pigs story. The story has no relevance contextually to specifically what I'm talking about, but a piece of it ties in, and the piece is that it requires dedication, determination, and discipline. So that's my highlight point, but that's a parable. Parables are fantastic. Parables wouldn't work in the model that I just shared of identifying a problem, the pain it causes, and three kind of byproducts of that pain, and then the solution, and then the outcome with three specifics aligned, you know, why the outcome was good. And then, of course, the action. A parable wouldn't fit in there. It's not necessary. So different stories, different context, different outcome. Stories are cool because done well, they create, they bring an audience into the story. Technically, one of the things I wrote down recently was people don't care about your story. They care about theirs. And if...
It's a great observation.
And they do, right? Like, we walk around in the world just going like, how does something serve me? We spend more time in our head thinking about our own needs than other people. And that's not a bad thing. That's just human nature. So we don't so much want to hear other people's stories. We want to hear stories that are directed. We are in that story.
That we can see ourselves in.
We can see ourselves in that story. So, you know, on stage there, identifying and creating a customer success story where the customer is positioned as the hero and we are their trusted guide, right? So if I'm the guide of a story, I'm not the main character.
Yeah.
And I think the big mistake that people make is they struggle. It's like they make themselves by accident the hero of the story.
When you're Mr. Miyagi.
Yeah. Yeah, you are, right? The Karate Kid, he's the hero.
Yeah.
Miyagi's just that wise dude in the background that was like, paint my fence.
wax on, wax off.
Yeah. You know, it just comes in for a moment and just gives a few clean, clear things, and then you go off and do the work necessary to get this amazing, amazing outcome for you. Stories can do that if they're structured really well. But stories will also, the cool part of a story is, a well-structured story will force a natural emotional arc into the narrative, right? So if we just stick with problem, pain, solution, outcome, action. So if there's a problem, we naturally take people on a down, on a dip. And it's like, oh, my tone, my position, my gestures, my face will hopefully, if I'm actually empathetic, will dip.
Yeah.
And then when I go into that's the problem, and then when I go into the pain, it's going to go like further down, right? And my body physiology is going to drop down. My face is going to drop down. My tone's going to drop down. It's going to be softer. But then I can't stay there for too long because, well, I'm just burning adrenaline and cortisol in my audience, all the people listening.
Yeah.
Can't keep them there. I want to lift them out of there and start hitting them with some dopamine and serotonin and endorphins. So I want to come out of there and be like, but then there was an outcome. And of course, my body is going to change. It's going to come up. My tone and pitch is going to go up. My gestures are going to come from low to up higher. My face is going to start to go higher.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to go to the outcome that was amazing. Story does that naturally.
Mm.
Yeah. So it prompts you to do the things that maybe you wouldn't naturally do. A good story, structured and well thought out plan will do that.
I'm interested in the physiology there. You take us through cortisol, serotonin, dopamine.
Mm.
What are the chemical ingredients of a good story arc?
Just exactly that, right? So generally we're going to start off on a high, mm-hmm. which is like, hey everyone.
Yep.
Right? And the people are like, because I want to trigger friend. Right? I don't want to trigger doom.
Yes.
Right? Because then they're like, I don't know if I trust you. And of course, they're going to look for reasons to back that up for the next however long you talk. So I'm going to start on a high, pitch them up high, but then I want to have contrast. And the contrast is drop.
Mm-hmm.
And then the contrast is lift. Drop. Lift. Lilia Taubera. I coached Lilia Taubera to... So Lilia is the former... She's the daughter, granddaughter of the founder of Gloria Vale, the religious cult on the west coast of the South Island. I coached Lilia to speak at TEDx for 18 minutes. Now, Lilia was going to share a story out of her book, and I was like, well, that's pointless because we can read it in your book. Let's create a talk that talks about what you couldn't write in your book because it was too hard. Now, when Lilia started speaking, naturally, there was so much trauma within her story, within her talk, and it was just like off the edge of a cliff, and like down and down and down. And I'm like, and you can just feel, you know, like
the energy being sucked out of you.
But what happens is your body is on high alert, right? So with adrenaline, spiked adrenaline, and cortisol, you're burning energy hard, but your ability to remember stuff is compromised. Your ability to focus, you are agitated.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things happen when you're in a state of fight, flight, freeze, or forget. So you're triggering that unconsciously.
Mm.
And this is happening in business meetings. This is all around the world. This is happening. People are doing it, right? Like banging on the table, going, I need you to focus. Boom. Straight away, people are like, I can't focus because I'm in fight or flight. So we know that. So with Lydia, we had to change it to go, we start high. And then, yeah, we're just going to have periods where it was like, poof, and it's just like the audience just goes, woof, and there's a shock and emotional connection of this. That was really awful.
Mm.
But we can't leave them there.
Yeah.
So we need to pick them up. And when we pick them up, we have our visual imagery that picks them back up. You know, we use all of our tools.
Yeah.
We use our body. We use our images, our slides. Our slides are not going to have 15 million words on them because we're not going to change people's emotions through that. We're going to change it through a big image of a face smiling close up.
Mm.
And people's mirror neurons in their brain will see it and go, and their chemicals will start to rebuild and they feel good again.
Mm.
And then we're going to drop them again later on, right? So we're taking them because we've got contrast. When we have contrast, we avoid mono emotion. Right? Because we don't want to hold people in an emotion too long. We have mono emotion, so more emotional flux within it so that we're putting people up and bringing them down. But we're doing it all consciously.
Yeah.
There's a lot to this subject.
Can you share? So what's the name of that presentation? Can we find it on YouTube?
Yeah, definitely. Check it out. So I coached Lilia for that, and that was my kind of claim to fame, actually. So Lilia challenged me when we were working together. First speaker that's ever done this for TED, right? For TEDx. She said, I'll do this thing. We'll change it to make it where I'm sharing raw parts of, you know, my story that I've never shared before. Thank you very much. If you agree that you help me get 3 million views on YouTube.
Okay.
I was like,
performance incentive, sure.
Yeah, sure. So I did a lot of research on what it would take to make that happen. And Lilia became the most viewed TEDx talk in New Zealand, the fifth most viewed on the planet. She was uploaded to TED Official, transcribed into six languages, and she's been viewed over 12.5 million times. The talk is, I grew up in a religious cult. It was heaven and hell.
great, I mean, great subject line. Sorry, straight off the bat.
That was it, right? I actually searched, so subject lines, offshoot topic. Subject lines, the title of your talk, what impact does it have on your audience? So I just started researching what are the highest viewed TED Talks on the platform and what were the titles?
Okay.
My son was the Columbine shooter. There's a grabber. Once you watch this, your brain will never be the same. 55 million views.
Jeez.
But what was really interesting, and this is maybe a presentation in itself, right? So I watched the person who had that title, once you watch this, your brain will never be the same. I watched the video, and I saw something I hadn't seen much in TED before. You see it occasionally, but with their comforter, stage comforter monitor, so in the US it's a comforter, right? Speaker comforter, which are just your screens in front of you. You've got your timer, you've got your slides, and
it's not a soft blanket, just to be clear.
Well, no, it can be, it helps, right? On it, I saw their full script, and they were actually doing the full script, and the content within it was nothing that you probably hadn't heard of or found before.
Interesting.
The title is what made people click on it and watch it for the duration necessary to give it a view.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as soon as you see that number go up, well, if other people think it's worth watching, I need to click on it.
Yep.
So one title has spiked a talk to over 55 million views on TED because of the title.
Now, the question that I have to ask, logically, is what then do we title this episode of We Do B2B?
I need to think about that.
Put you on the spot there.
Well, technically, so I think it's... it needs to be less than 120 or 144 characters or 123 characters, right?
Okay.
It's got to be less than that. It's got to be memorable, repeatable, and very shareable. Those are your keys for it. But I think, you know, come back to that as a subject. I think it's a great subject on its own. The key with it, though, is what does that title of your talk, how does that title focus your thoughts?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does that title bring your thoughts of what you're speaking about, like, down into a really fine edge point? Because if it's too ambiguous, well, you can talk about anything. And that creates a problem, because now your talk is just, it's kind of something for everyone. And talks shouldn't be something for everyone. They should be very pinpointed.
And is that to say that you look to consciously alienate, or that you just know your audience?
The audience that comes to hear that talk... come to hear that talk.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So it's making sure that the billboard is bringing in the people who really, really want to listen to it. 100%.
Yeah. Because if you've got an eclectic audience and you've got an eclectic talk, and at the end of it, people go, how was the talk? It's like, yeah, it was all right.
Mm. Yeah.
But if you've got a targeted title, a targeted talk, and a very targeted audience, you go, how was that talk? And they're like, life-changing. Because that talk is made for them.
So I've got my cogs whirring now. I'm lost in my own question. What are we going to call this thing? Because there's so many pearls of wisdom in this, in what you're saying. What for me really, really stands out here is that every time we as marketers are trying to put something across, we should be performing. We should be thinking about even down to the name of the meeting invite. You know, that's the subject line that we're talking about, making sure that we've set the right tone, that we've got the appetite in the room.
What's the visual image those words place in a person's head?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, because words are visual, right? Like toothbrush. You can't help but go, yeah, I just found one in my brain, thanks.
I'm bristling.
Yeah, right? you're seeing it there, and it's just one word, toothbrush. Yep. So if words do that, then the meetings that you have, what emotional, what do you want to evoke emotionally with them?
Mm.
And I mean, we have a tendency to, and as a side topic, we have a tendency to not consider the words we use when we use them. Are we using towards language or away from language? Are we using language that drives behavior forward, or language that's driving people away from something they're scared of? Towards something they want, or away from something they're scared of.
Do you have an example of either of those?
Yeah, for sure. So these are the things that in the future we don't want to do.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, first and foremost, if we're not doing that, what are we doing instead? Yeah. Well, the answer to that would be, the change in language would be, in the future, this is what we will do.
Mm. Yep.
But go into any bathroom and what does it say? please don't do something.
Mm.
As opposed to, I mean, even in offices, don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. And it's like, ah, what do you want us to do? And oftentimes there's this big, you know, we really respect everything that you do and who you are as a person and blah, 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 but please don't do this. And it's like...
the shit sandwich, yeah.
Totally the shit sandwich. And it's like, well, let's get rid of that. You can make it shorter and more concise and go, flush after use. You're awesome. There you go. And people are going to read it. They're going to... the action is like... Whoa,
yeah.
Push the button. Right? Like... And then you're awesome. It's like incentive. But yeah, that's not the world we live in at the moment. It's overly complicated. I'm going to add to that, right? So I'm going to add a stat to it, which is currently we have, what is it? 86% of people around the world are disengaged in their work. Well, not disengaged, sorry. 86% of people around the world, the problems we have in businesses around communication are 86%. And it's between collaboration and communication.
Okay.
It's collaboration and communication. 86% of the work problems in workforces are because of those two things. 79% of the workforce are disengaged. So if you do the math between the 86% and 79%, well, it's like, well, if communication and collaboration are the problem, well, no wonder 79% of people are disengaged. And my brain goes, well, how does that happen? How do you do that? And it's like, well, what you do is you get people up here to structure content and deliver it to people who are down here. And it's like, well, what do you mean? Is this a hierarchy? And it's like, no, it's actually the average reading comprehension age in New Zealand, Australia, and the US is 12 to 14 years old.
That's alarming.
So the people up here who are crafting content and messages probably went to university.
Mm. People who are consuming those messages
did not.
Mm.
And people want to sound smart, mm. right? Like there's this ego just burning away. Like, I can't say that. It sounds too simple and childlike. It's like, well, if you don't, you know, it's like, I'll sound like an idiot if I use such simple language. It's like, would you be an idiot if you actually gave out content knowing that the people reading it have no idea what incongruent and congruent mean?
Mm.
By the way, so congruent is that when two things match, and incongruent is when they don't match. Right? Like, I literally have to teach this to some people. It's like, yeah, but I need to sound academic. It's like, fine, can you use the phrase in other words? So we have, you know, there was an incongruence between what they were saying and what they were doing. In other words, shit didn't match. And it's like, right, I've catered to my academic ego, yeah. But I've also catered to the people in the room. They're like, I totally get what you're talking about.
And now I know what incongruence means. Yeah.
Exactly, right? You've educated me at the same time. But the cool part being is, if you do it, people will stay with you on your journey, your message journey. But if you don't do it, you've got people over here going, what does incongruent mean?
Mm.
And you're still doing this.
Yeah.
And they're like, wake up 20 minutes later going, I have no idea what incongruence is, and I must be an idiot because I don't know. So you've alienated a portion of your audience as well. And then they wake up going, what was that?
Missed the point, sorry.
Missed the point because I was lost back there.
And because your meeting invite was FY2,
totally.
Q2 financial review, looking forward.
This is where real consideration, compassion, kindness comes into it, right?
Mm.
It's like, if we actually focus our attention more on the needs of others than we do on ourselves, we can change the world, literally.
I'd normally ask for another question at this point, but I feel like that's our conclusion. Mic drop out. Boom. No, I love that. Thank you so much for sharing. It's actually been a really interesting conversation for me. I'm just reflecting on my own journey here as a podcast host. There's so many things that producer Louis has kind of picked me up and kind of coached me on along the way. Mm. And your point about trying to sound academic and smart, I kept shooting myself in the foot. He's pointing at me right now. I kept shooting myself in the foot trying to ask questions that made me sound smart.
Yeah.
We ended up coming up with the mantra of treat them like an archaeologist.
Yeah.
If I was interviewing an archaeologist, I wouldn't have a fucking clue what you're talking about, and I can happily ask ignorant questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hopefully I've asked some ignorant questions through this conversation.
Those are fantastic questions. Thank you.
Good stuff.
Really good questions that get my brain thinking, right? Like, with any person that lives and works in what they do, we can get lost in that sometimes. So being asked questions around what I do helps me to flesh out more of like the ins and outs of what I do as well and why I do it too.
Yeah, and lots of insights for the audience to take away. So thank you so much.
Pleasure, thank you.
That's that. Thanks for listening to We Do B2B by Blue Ocean. Now, brace for CTAs. If you want to join and grow the community, make sure to subscribe wherever your eyes and ears absorb information. Don't forget to switch on notifications so you know when the latest episodes drop. And for more B2B goodness, be sure to follow Blue Ocean, the B2B agency, on LinkedIn. Now look, you know how this next piece works. The more reviews we get, the faster this thing grows. So please do for us what you'd hope your customers would do for you. Leave a review and share your thoughts. Let's stay connected and keep the B2B marketing conversation going.